Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Yogan Rasanayakam, General Manager, Westpac Banking Corporation, past co-chairman of the Bankers Association for Finance and Trade, Asia Pacific, and globally recognized banking senior executive. Yogan, you bring to this interview a substantive history of significant and considerable national and international contribution. We are fortunate to have you share your many deep experiences with the audience. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, Stephen. I look forward to having a chat to you today.
Yogan, you were an invited Fortune 1000 Distinguished Delegate to the Beijing 4th International CEO Roundtable, Chinese and Foreign Multinational Corporations. And this was all due to your globally recognized leadership, and it was a real pleasure talking with you at that summit. So what were your goals at the summit, or what do you feel were the goals at the summit?
I think my takeout from the conference from a China perspective was China showing a degree of leadership in areas where there have been, in recent times, I think, some degree of critical feedback for them, particularly from the many of the Western countries. So they were showing a high degree of leadership in the areas of low-carbon economic development. They were looking at food and drug safety responsibility. 12 to 24 months ago, there was a issue with the milk powder. So this was to show that, you know, China is taking these issues very seriously. There was further discussion in the areas of protection of intellectual property, and an area where I spoke about, which is on corporate and social responsibility, leadership on that area as well. So it was, in essence, showing that what's important to the world was important to China, and leading the way for the future. And China sees itself very much now as part of the global leadership, and they do want to exert that leadership far more than that they have been doing in the past.
So why did you participate at the summit?
For two reasons. I mean, I enjoy going to these summits for, one, networking. I find it's an incredible place to meet people, and as a consequence, of course, I met you, and which is a fantastic experience. And the other is I also find that these conferences give me the ability to listen to various other perspectives which I don't necessarily share, where people have a different lens to mine. And it's an opportunity for me to understand where they see opportunities, where they see challenges. And, you know, one thing about Asia and China in particular is that if you're a foreigner, regardless of the time you spent in that region, you're always a foreigner. So it's always, there's subtleties that you learn from listening to the local people, the local perspective. And the great thing about this summit was that there was a large number of senior executives from China who were there, and particularly on the break sessions and the evening coffees and teas and dinners, where you were able to mingle and chat to people. There was a perspective that I took a lot away from. I mean, normally when I go, I end up meeting people of equal, of a similar sort of industry. And this was an opportunity to meet people from various other industries. So I found an incredible source of information and insights, which is why I participated in the conference.
So you sort of touched on this already, but perhaps you can expand a bit more and tell us more about your work and your memorable experiences at this Beijing conference.
Our experience, well, I spoke about corporate and social responsibility. Westpac in Australia has had a long history on corporate and social responsibility. So it was an exciting opportunity for me to be able to share that information in China, where a lot of these aspects are just starting to occur, particularly in the workforce. My memorable experience, as I mentioned, is that actually was meeting the new people. I mean, as I mentioned, I love to meet people and to listen to their stories and insights. And, you know, just sitting to and talking about people, even in the corporate social responsibility areas where different elements are being, which we're not touching upon in Westpac, has been touched by other organizations, which is fascinating when, you know, there's a learning experience there to then go back and apply that. You know, one thing I would say is that, you know, each country is different, so therefore, whilst the ethos and the theme of a corporate social responsibility may be similar, the application is different. So it was fascinating to listen to them. And of course, there were a lot of other areas as well, which I found fascinating.
You know, could you summarize then what you consider to be your top lessons that you kind of took away from this really remarkable summit?
In terms of the top 10 lessons or top lessons that I took away from it was that the summit itself was, I thought, was very candid. And China was making a point about continuing to be making a contribution, particularly on environmentally friendly, low-carbon technologies, which is a theme that is coming out more and more, not just from the government, particularly in the banking sector. We hear that all the time from the local regulator, but also from companies and corporate agencies, which are starting to move towards that. The other few areas were, you know, we had an interesting talk on emphasizing of the open economy, and which is an interesting and a challenging discussion, as you could imagine, in China. And yet there was a reasonably open discussion on that topic, which I took away as being China getting mature to be able to talk about challenging topics. So I found that interesting. The other part, I think, was that there are a lot of what they call state-owned enterprises or local government-owned agencies, which are, you know, which are large by world standards now, which own oil companies, etc., are globalizing, and the recognition by those companies that in order when they go to these new markets, they need to be able to work in the local markets that they're going into to boost the local economy, not just Chinese economy. So that was an interesting theme that I hadn't heard of. I mean, I've been going to China for a very long time. That was a theme that was starting to come more commonly out of that conference. And the other ones were the more standard ones about, you know, ensuring there was capital management, ensuring there was, you know, stronger governance in terms of the banking sector, which are all, you know, themes that have been prevalent, particularly since the global financial crisis. And one final area which was interesting, and we're not seeing it in our sector at the moment, which is the financial services sector, but it seems to be in other industry groups where a lot of foreigners are now going and working for Chinese companies. And I think a part of that has been driven by the recent global financial crisis and employment being difficult, particularly in Europe and parts of the US. And we're finding, I think, highly skilled people from the West going and working for Chinese companies, and that was a trend that was articulated with facts and figures. So I found those were my takeaways, that there was a variety of themes, but most of them were, you know, the new trends that are happening in the China market.
You know, that's interesting. You know, you do come from the banking sector, so how would you sort of judge the Chinese kind of approach to banking over this financial crisis and what led to the financial crisis versus, you know, sort of the Western kind of view and way of doing things?
The Chinese banks the Chinese financial services sector or Asia as a whole haven't been necessarily impacted by the global financial crisis for many reasons. One was that Asia as a whole went through the Asian crisis in the late 90s. So they had restructured their financial services sector and particularly the supervision of that was a lot tighter. And in the case of China, they have gone basically from a closed economy with strong governance in terms of how to do business into a more of an open economy. And in the process of doing that, they've been tapping into the world's best practices. I think the big difference between some of the challenges the West particularly had felt in the US and the Europe was not necessarily the policies didn't exist. It was the supervision of those policies. In China, I think the supervision of those policies is quite stringent. And, of course, China being a high-growth country, the challenges that, you know, we in the West have faced in terms of employment, et cetera, which have impacted the financial services industry as much as anything else, hasn't impacted it as much. And, you know, there's an enormous amount of liquidity in the China market. And so some of the challenges that we face in the West haven't come through. So I think it's a bit of a, it's a completely, it's a slightly different perspective to what's happening in China versus the West. And you know, emerging markets go through different challenges versus the developed market. And you know, in China, whilst the financial services sector has, you know, the cost of employment has risen significantly, it is still very much lower than the West. So in terms of having the number of banks I think ICBC Bank, which is the biggest bank in the world, has employees of over 500,000. I mean, that's something that I can't even imagine as a number of, people being employed. So, you know, these numbers are frightening numbers. So for them, that 500,000, probably the collective salaries that they would pay wouldn't be significant compared to, you know, the financial services sector in the West.
That's really fascinating. I mean, where do you see China then in 5-10 years? You know, you hear these figures, like I saw something from the conference board out of the U.S. saying that China will surpass the U.S. in PPP GDP by 2012, or that next year in another report, China will surpass the U.S. in patents, that is yearly filing of patents, or they graduate something like almost a million engineers a year versus, let's say, 60,000 engineers a year. I mean, let's say in the U.S., what kind of impact will that have, all of these kind of leadership positions that they're taking worldwide?
I think China, I mean, if we look at the financial services sector, in the top three banks in the world are now Chinese. And that's because of the sheer size of that. But I wouldn't underestimate the importance of the U.S. going forward in terms of innovation. I think in terms of innovation, whilst the numbers of patency might be more in China because of the sheer volume, but in terms of the sheer change in perspective in terms of global impact, I think it will still be coming out of the U.S. For some time yet. I think China will be very much a dominant force. People are saying in this part of the world that, you know, the next 100 years is Asia. The last 100 years was in the, you know, in Europe and the US. The next 100 years here is in Asia. And I think that's true. But I think in terms of the aspect of strong leadership in all aspects, I think Asia has still some distance to go before it achieves those goals. But it is without a doubt, you know, quickly coming to higher levels of parity in many aspects. Certainly in terms of the financial services sector, as I said, you know, the banking industry is there. They have the CBRC, which is the China Banking Regulatory Commission, which oversees them, is well led. It has got a good governance regime being implemented in the region, and they buy the best minds from the world to ensure that China ends up being a leader. So I think, you know, all of those fundamentals are there for China to become a true leader in every sense of the word. But I think I don't think the U.S. is still there's a long way before I think the U.S. will be surpassed in many of the other aspects.
So how is your Mandarin?
My Mandarin is poor. My daughter's Mandarin is superb.
Well, that's good to hear. It sounds like you're creating the next generation of, you know, sort of international citizen.
Well, that's right. I think if we're in this part of the world, it is amazing how people of my generation, and particularly when you talk about our children, they are very much international citizens, where they're learning languages. Which a few years ago, I learned French when I was a kid, and because that seemed to be the way forward. But certainly in this day and age, you know, it's either you learn Mandarin, Spanish, or Indonesian. Because those are the languages that seems to be. In addition to English, which are the ones that are for the future. So the emerging markets, the BRIC countries, are the ones that, you know, everyone is focusing on. And certainly our children are learning those languages that will put them in, hopefully, in good stead for their future.
Yes, I would agree. Very, very true. In fact, I just saw a report on Brazil that they're, fifth in GDP now? In fact, ahead of England or France. And I just thought that was quite remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we think back to the 90s, where, you know, what position Brazil was in to versus where they are today, you know, it's amazing. I mean, India is in a similar sort of position. I mean, India was virtually bankrupt in early 91, 92, I think. And to think now that, you know, they're considered to be, they and China are the major drivers of growth in this part of the world, is something that is an amazing turnaround, and certainly Brazil falls into the same category, without a doubt.
I know that you have this sort of remarkable background of long-term success, and you've done many, many things all in a sort of exemplary manner. So can you outline your prior roles and what you learned in those roles?
Yeah, I've been in in this company for 23 years. It's my second job. I mean, I was with another organization for a short year, a few years before I joined here with Westpac. And in those 23 years, or half my time has been here in Asia, initially as a CFO for the region. And then I went back to do M&A for Westpac. And then I came back in late 2004, to do this role. My background has been principally driven by my, I was born in a country and moved to another country to live. So I was born of Sri Lankan background, brought up in New Zealand and then lived in Australia. So I've been moving around quite a bit as a child. And as a consequence of that, I tend to have a fairly inquisitive mind in terms of cultures, and I absolutely enjoy learning about other people and other cultures. And of course, the food that each of these bring is something that I enjoy. In terms of work, I think my learnings have come from basically traveling around, principally with work and working, dealing with different people, whether it be in Japan or Korea or in Australia. And with, and each country brings its own values and benefits, and hopefully, you know, we learn from it. Sometimes, of course, we have to learn it more than once because we we don't remember some of the mistakes from the past. But the reality, yeah, I mean, I've had a very fortunate life in being able to travel and be able to participate in various elements, but within Westpac in different areas, from being a CFO to M&A to structured finance, and now in this current role.
You know, I'm just sort of curious. I know that prior to your current role, you were head of merger and acquisitions for Westpac Banking Corporation, and then you're also past co-chairman of the Bankers Association for Finance and Trade Asia Pacific.
Yeah.
On the M&A side, can you maybe just maybe share a few best practices?
Yeah, the way we used to, from a Westpac perspective, is that we used to look at a few things that made before we went into any transactions. And the best practice for us is ensuring that, you know, we did the homework really thoroughly. We would research and do the due diligence. And we used to have, you know, two or three little maxims that we would consider. One was that, you know, was it strategic? Every transaction we looked at, we would ask the question, is this strategic in terms of the strategy that the bank and the company and the board has undertaken and had promised the shareholders? Number two was that, you know, was it going to be financially beneficial, obviously, which is the standard question everyone asks. And in that sense, we would do significant amount of financial research in terms of, you know, analysis through discounted cash flows to PE analysis, into comparisons, market comparisons of what similar organizations should be yielding and the like. And the third component was, you know, what we used to call, is this doable? And what we meant by that was effectively, you know, from a regulatory standpoint, are we doing the right thing? From a customer point standpoint, are we doing the right thing? Because after all, the reputational impact of what we were about to impart was very, very important. So, you know, in that were the cultural elements of it as well. Sometimes, you know, two companies, which may look very similar, have different cultures, and different drivers. And it was important for us to do the diligence. So we would, you know, when we interviewed and discussed with senior management, we would ask ourselves, you know, is that management ethos going to manage, is going to mix well with our team? Because that was all very important in terms of the synergy benefits you would get in, you know, enjoy once you integrate. And if you didn't do that well, then, you know, usually the part of the acquisition is the people, because they're, you know, they're the ones that bringing the IP with you, you know, intellectual property. And if you start losing them, then, you know, it was a major loss. So we would go through a fairly thorough process in terms of the analysis. And I think those disciplines of looking at the way we do business was something that I think I've been able to bring to this current job, in ensuring that we were very systematic. We didn't necessarily follow for the sake of following. We had our own strategic agenda, and we, you know, matched that to our outcome. And we didn't want to be all things to all people. We wanted to be ensuring that we were following our own strategic goals. So those have been good lessons to pick up and come through to this current job.
Well, that's a kind of a natural segue then into my next question, and that is, can you outline your current roles and your goals?
Yeah, so in terms of our current role, Westpac has been in Asia for some period of time. However, unlike a lot of the other companies, we've been focusing on supporting Australian and New Zealand client bases that have been coming to Asia and supporting Asian clients going to Australia and New Zealand. So in essence, supporting clients who have linkages back to Australia and New Zealand. And the reason for that is being followed by, you know, basic fundamentals, which is that we've been following the flows in terms of what links Australia as a country and as an economy. The three biggest elements of that are that there's a significant amount of trade flows between Australia and Asia. In terms of Australia and Asia, 60% of Australia's exports are now consumed by Asian countries. And out of the top six Australian trading nations, five are in Asia and the other one is the US. So, you know, we followed the fundamentals there in terms of the trade flows. The other area that we focused on is capital flows. There's a significant amount of capital that tends to have flow between two ways between Asia and Australia, and we've been following that and has been trying to support our clients based in that. And the final one is people. There's migrant flows and student flows that occurs between Australia and this region. There's well over 100,000 students from China alone studying in Australia at the moment every year, and there's a significant amount of Indian students as well, close to 70,000, I think, who are in Australia as well. So we've tapped into areas where we think we have a comparative advantage. And, you know, we ask ourselves all the time, you know, why would anyone come to Westpac versus some other organization who can provide probably the similar sort of services? And the reason is that because we've been in Australia for a long time, in fact, Westpac is the oldest bank in Australia. We were established in 1817, so we'll be nearly 200 years in about 7 years' time, and we're also the oldest company. So we believe we understand the market really well. We've been in the market for a very long time, and in New Zealand we've been there since 1860. So Australia and New Zealand is our core market, and we essentially are supporting our clients in those markets and using those expertise that we picked up from those markets to support our clients here in Asia. So large extent, it's a customer-driven strategy that we're here for.
So looking at this a little bit more broader, then, what are the major challenges that your industry is facing, and what are the solutions to those challenges?
I think in terms of the challenges we're facing is that, you know, as I mentioned, the West as a whole is, you know, in particular the developed countries, is going through a lower economic growth. And so you have to look for markets with high economic growth. So Asia is one of them. In the low economic growth markets, so therefore in order to be successful and compete with the emerging market, what we have to look at globally is productivity. And then in Australia is not immune to that. So constantly companies have to look at productivity in terms of how can you be more effective as a company to be able to compete. So that's now the second element of, I think, which is an important element. The third aspect of it is that particularly with the global financial crisis, and I think it was occurring in Asia a bit earlier than that, and even in Australia a bit earlier than before that, in Asia with the Asian crisis, is that there are tougher regulatory controls that are being considered and are being introduced. Under those environments, all organizations and all companies have to work under those and to be effective and be competitive. And it might not be necessarily a playing field, the same playing field from country to country. Some countries would have tougher regulatory environments and then others. So if you're a global or regional player, participant, then you need to be able to be effective in different markets. In the case of Australia, and generally in the West, the cost of funding in the banking industry has gone up significantly. Once upon a time, liquidity was freely available. Now it isn't. So particularly long-term funding now, as you are aware, Stephen, it's quite expensive and it's a challenge. Third, I think the other, but fifthly, I think, you know, the new Basel requirements for capital that are coming through need to be strongly considered and managed for future growth of organizations, particularly financial institutions. And I think, you know, governments around the world are introducing new consumer protection measures all the time and new rules in terms of risk management. So again, that brings in a new dynamism in terms of how to compete. And so all in all, I think the competition and the type of competition we're seeing is changing. And you know, as I said earlier on, even in the banking industry 10 years ago, the major players in the banking industries were American or European and maybe some Japanese. now the, you know, the new emerging competitors are from China and Southeast Asia and India. And so then the competition we're seeing is a different type of competition with different types of drivers. So, you know, there's a, so globally, you know, we're seeing about 7 or 8 trends that, you know, we need to consider to be successful, and compete.
I guess the other side of the question then is sort of what are the major innovations and opportunities in your industry, and then what actions can be taken to take advantage of these opportunities?
I think the innovations are quite exciting. I think the innovations that we're seeing is with globalization is technology, and the significant amount of interconnectivity that is occurring. So, you know, innovations that are coming out of which is being applied in the US, which is coming out of places like India and so on, are quite incredibly interesting. And the other element of that is that, you know, there's been newly created, I guess, networks, new networks which are starting to occur, particularly in the trade side. You know, I think I was reading recently where the trade flows between China and Africa has been growing by 30% over the recent years. So, you know, if you think back, that goes almost to 200 years in terms of, you know, to get that type of growth rate. So, you know, there's new types of networks that are starting to occur. And, you know, the other elements of it is, and, you know, what we've seen coming out of the WikiLeaks and so on, is that these social networks are starting to play a significant role in how we operate. So, you know, in our industry, for example, it is not, you know, I don't see, maybe within the next year or two, we might start having people starting to send us feedback, either through tweeting or complaining, you know, customer complaints or customer feedback might be coming through tweets as well as Facebook and the like. So the social network and the power of the social networks are starting to occur, and, you know, and that is a challenge at the same time. It's a great opportunity to be able to get into a new marketplace. And I think the part that excites me the most is that there are about, I believe, about 2.5 billion people who are still unbanked in this world, and particularly in the emerging markets. And those are the people that I think we have a great ability to innovate and work with through technology. And the ability to have, you know, a mechanism for inclusion in terms of through innovation, in terms of being able to provide financial literacy through better education and process. Those are kind of innovations that are actually very, very exciting from not just from a financial services point of view, but just generally from a social point of view. And, you know, I think when we were at the conference, we were briefly talking about what Grameen Bank has done, for example. And that type of innovation for me is something for the future, because that effectively brings the whole world together. I mean, we've been talking about globalization in many ways, but this is true globalization when you're able to have all people participate in a manner that is more equal than in the past.
You know, I'm sort of struck by this sort of concept that you're talking about, and that is the sort of technology underlying many of the sort of essential aspects of innovation and opportunities and even sort of democratizing banking worldwide, so everybody kind of has access to it. So are there kind of rigid standards then in terms of the professionals that work in the IT side of the industry? Or, I mean, does the banking industry require some kind of accreditation or certification of any sort?
Usually, you know, large organizations end up dealing with companies which are, you know, a reputable standard, obviously. And, you know, big banks end up dealing with big technology companies. But interestingly, the best innovations tend to come from people who have an idea which is then tapped into. And you know, to give credit to the large organizations such as the Microsofts and so on, they do seem to be able to, you know, to be able to harness that enormous amount of talent pool that's out there and maximize. So there's an, you know, incredible amount of skunkworks. And when you read about how certain things have developed, you're amazed how it's, you know, it's emerged out of a garage somewhere in, you know, somewhere in Silicon Valley, and someone who had nothing suddenly emerged, you know, whether it's Google or whatever. So I think that generally speaking, the big banks and big large corporates, whether they be, you know, financial institutions or other organizations, they tend to work with large reputable companies. So I think there's a degree of self-management and self-control that comes out of that. There aren't know, you don't get the hacker type of people working on it, because at the end of the day, you know, our survival is based on reputation, and to do that, you do need to have good, strong governance to be able to capture that. And certainly, in the financial services sector, the mechanisms under which we go through technology is very, very rigid, in the sense of strong governance in terms of how we approach implementation of new systems and processes. You know, there's a design phase, there's a approval phase for all our elements of it. So, you know, they aren't something that you grab and just put into place. There's an enormous amount of regulatory clearances that we need to clear through as well. There's internal governance that goes through, and then once the internal governance is ensured, there's audit processes, etc., to make sure that the customer's information is protected.
Well, that's interesting. You know, you just mentioned sort of regulatory processes, audit processes, strong governance, which ties into standards and quality. And I guess, you know, from my perspective, I mean, I come from the IT industry, you know, that there's this sort of professionalism program. So that would all add to the professionalism being, you know, IT is a recognized profession where there are, you know, certification standards and accreditation standards. Something that I'm curious about, though, and that in the banking industry, does IT have a seat at the executive committee level, or does it report to the chief financial officer? I mean, is it sort of an equal position?
In Westpac, they have an absolute seat at the executive level. And so our chief technology officer reports straight to the CEO. And considering the amount of investment that we do, and it's not just us, I think if you look at most financial institutions, they spend a lot of money on technology, and it's in the billions. So having a direct relationship with the chief executive officer is very important, and I think you find most organizations, large, well-run governed organizations, tend to have that, and we certainly do.
So then what are the top global forces shaping your industry?
I think, as I said, some of the things I think I mentioned before, but in terms of the global forces, the next 100 years, as I mentioned earlier, is going to be about the emerging markets. So because it's going to be the emerging markets, to be able to be effective, we need to be able to participate in these developing markets, because there's going to be a whole new group of middle class that are going to come in with a whole new value chains and new market infrastructures and so on. And to be able to understand and to be able to participate in that is going to be very, very important. I mentioned about productivity. I think that's going to be essential. New models due to globalization means that, you know, we need to have better technology and better ability to be able to handle those new models, better processes. I think corporate social responsibility, which I've spoken about, is going to be quite essential, particularly with the scarce resource such as clean air and water and fuel. I think wherever I now go in this region, people are always talking about companies like us who have carbon trading activities, you know, how they can tap into those technologies and information or IP. And so that's going to be very important. You know, we all have to think about it, and I think all large organizations, and as we talked about earlier today at the summit, that was an important discussion point. And of course, the most, I think one of the elements that is going to be important, particularly for the developed countries, including China and developing countries like China and as well, is going to be the aging population. I think, you know, it's going to be how we manage those people who are, you know, because when I grew up, I was of the view that, you know, there was always going to be a safety net. There was going to be, when I retire, my contributions that I make for my pension would return me a realistic amount of, you know, revenue to be able to survive till I die. But that's clearly not going to be the case. I mean, I was in Japan earlier this week, and that's a big issue in Japan. I think it's going to be, in China, there's no safety net, and with the one-child policy, there is a significant issue in terms of the aging population. So how we handle those is going to be important. So, you know, those are the kind of global forces that are, again, it's a bit diverse, but certainly I think there's going to be many elements that are going to be driving the forces of globally for the next few years.
Jorgen, for you to be invited to this really global summit, quite a unique summit in Beijing of the top executives from the leading multinational corporations, really is a, I guess what it does is it spotlights you as one of the most significant executives out there in the world today, and with an incredible history of success. So let's kind of mine that. What are some pivotal lessons that you can share from this long history of national and international contribution and remarkable contribution to the world?
For me, I think, firstly, it's important from a personal point of view to embrace the good of everything, all the new markets that I've been to. But overall, the more important element is maintaining my values. You know, I don't believe, you know, regardless of cultural elements of it, you should ever compromise your values. So that's a one major lesson that I think, particularly in Asia, you do hear of all the time of, you know, corruption and so on. So it is important to maintain values and the like. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you can't embrace certain values, certain positive elements of that particular country. So, you know, I take that as a lesson. The other part about it is it's also increasingly finding that we need to understand the local customer needs. What works in your home market doesn't always work in new markets. Having said that, if you're coming to a new market, you must bring your A game. You can't, you know, you shouldn't come in with half-hearted. You know, the reality is that whilst China and India are developing markets, they aren't nascent markets. I mean, China and India have got rich history, you know, over thousands of years of history. So it's important that when you come to these markets, you ask yourself, what is your competitive advantage? And you are able to bring your best. And you have to compare yourself against your local and see whether you're able to bring your best and be able to compete. So that's an important lesson that I've learned. The other one is learn from your mistakes and be persistent and be patient. I think when you come to new markets and new opportunities, it looks, you know, it seems to be lined with silver, but the reality is that you have to be incredibly patient to achieve your goal. So, you know, I read the other day, you know, the best way to get a chicken is to hatch an egg and not to smash it. And I think that's very true of being in Asia, which is you have to be patient to be able to achieve your goals. And as I said earlier, I think it's very hard doing new markets. So when you come in, you have to come in with a long-term sustainable plan and understand that there's going to be bumps along the way. And because there's going to be bumps along the way, it's important to think about, you know, being there for long and think about broad. As we say in Westpac for our corporate social responsibility, it's important to have a long-term plan. Far too often you see companies coming in for the short-term profit and being incredibly unsuccessful. The companies who've lasted a long time are the ones that have had a long-term vision, long-term plan, and a long-term strategy. And the final element of it is that, you know, the most important element of anything that you do in any organization or anywhere is the people. They're your greatest asset. So it's very, very important to work very hard to get to win their hearts and minds. If you don't win the hearts and minds of your people, then it's going to be incredibly challenging to be successful in any new market. So that would be my lesson, in a summarized way, in being in this part of the world and working period of time.
Well, it's interesting that your lessons really apply to life in general and to really any industry, right? So in terms of making sure that you keep and deliver value, you know, sort of aligning with the local markets and bring your game, learn from your mistakes, be persistent, long-term sustainable planning, and it's all about winning or being and delivering value to people, but ensuring that your people are engaged in some way and you understand people. So those are kind of fundamental principles of life, I would say.
It is, yes. And I think, you know, as long as, and you know, people say this all the time, you know, you have to keep it simple. And I think if you keep it simple, I think the lessons are much easier. I mean, whether you're in the area of, you know, playing sport, people say, you know, to be successful, you've got to keep everything simple. And I think that applies to, as you quite rightly said, in life as well as in employment and in terms of whether it's in business or whatever. As long as the simplicity is the art of success, I think, to a large extent.
So let's now focus specifically on Westpac. Can you profile Westpac and its background?
Okay. Westpac was established in 1817. It's the oldest bank. It's also the oldest company. Westpac is a full bank, full-service bank in Australia and New Zealand. We provide wholesale banking, retail banking, wealth management, insurance, and we have over 10 million clients in Australia and New Zealand, and we have we are about $70 billion in market cap. We're a AA rated bank. We're only one of nine banks in the world that are now AA rated. And as a financial institution, certainly in the wholesale bank, we're a leader, and we have won many awards, particularly through the by Dow Jones in terms of our corporate sustainability index for 7 years in a row. So we have a rich history in Australia and New Zealand, and we've increasingly got a global rich history on the corporate and social responsibility aspect of it. So we're a strong bank, a long old bank in Australia and New Zealand. And in Asia, we have currently headquarters in Singapore, which looks after the region, and we have offices in Hong Kong, China, India, and Indonesia. Our strategy is not to be all things to all people, but to support our clients who have links in Australia and New Zealand, whether they are inward flowing or outward flowing. And we have about 150-odd employees in Asia. So when you compare that to, as I was talking about, ICBC Bank, which has about 500,000, Westpac as a whole has about 37,000 employees. So, you know, you can see the size difference between the two countries in terms of population as well as employee for a large organization.
So what are Westpac's regional trends?
Oh, the regional trends that we see are essentially, you know, if we look at India and China, you know, they're effectively growing at in the high single-digit numbers or even in the early teens. And when you compare that to Australia, which is in the low single teens, so we, you know, India is expected to grow at about 8%, and China is expected to grow about 9%, while Australia is only expected to grow about 2.5% over the next 5 years. So, you know, we see in terms of regional trends, Asia is a significant part of our growth story. In terms of cross-border trade between Australia and New Zealand and Asia, there's significant amount of trade have occurring, and 60% of our trade between Australia and the rest of the world is in Asia, particularly with China, India, Japan, and Korea. So, you know, we see that as an important part of element of what's happening within the region. In terms of the elements which are, you know, driving that, it's of course natural resources. Australia is full of natural resources, and it's basically the engine which is driving China and India at the moment, particularly in the areas of coal and other commodities. And increasingly, we're seeing an interest in agribusiness, with people wanting to, with, you know, food being an important part of any country's growth. And the technologies that Australia has in terms of its ability to grow even within drought-driven areas has seen a lot of interest coming out of that. We are also seeing in China and the other parts of Asia the incredible amount of trade surpluses and the massive amount of liquidity and deposit pools, which is quite different to Australia, where a lot of our savings go into a superannuation. As a consequence of that, the liquidity pools in Australia aren't as much as it is in Asia. In fact, you know, I think one of the interesting statistics is that the Shenzhen Stock Exchange has a higher turnover than the Frankfurt stock market. So there's an incredible amount of liquidity in this market. So we're trying to tap into that. And of course, we're seeing a large number of companies which are moving as regional headquarters into Asia, in particular Singapore. So we're focusing on tapping into that. Previously, that used to be either in Australia or tended to be in Japan. Now what we're seeing is that it's tending to be in Singapore or Hong Kong. So those are the regional trends that we're seeing, and that's one of the reasons why we've been focusing on China, India, and of course Singapore and Hong Kong for us as our key markets.
You've touched on some of these throughout the interview, but if you can summarize then, what are Westpac's competitive advantages, successes to date, and strategy and focus?
Our strategy is to grow our business in Asia organically, and we have a saying, growing offshore to grow onshore. And we believe that our success is based on the fact that we have a comparative advantage in the Australian and Kiwi expertise in the market, and we are leveraging off those expertise of our home markets and our global network that we have, you know, to be able to bring a cross-border element to our activities. In Australia, we are the number one wholesale bank, And as such, we're able to bring those expertise into this Asian market as well. The other reason, I think, is that, as I mentioned a little earlier, is that we're one of only 9 banks in the world which is AA rated. And because we're a AA rated bank, we're able to maximize those high ratings into the Asian market. And, you know, because we've been recognized as a globally as an Aussie expert, we're able to then utilize that Aussie experts and expertise and strength throughout, not just Australasia, but into the Asian markets. And we've been able to use that as a comparative advantage with our client base.
So we're going to, again, broaden sort of the questions here and get into sort of the whole idea of trends, future trends. And, you know, you've got this with all the traveling you do and the fact that you're the senior executive who's highly respected, you're in a perfect position to maybe provide a prediction of future trends. And you've done some of that already, but maybe you can do some more in terms of their implications and opportunities.
Yeah, I think the one of the biggest trends, I think, is that element of tapping into the 2.4 billion or 2.5 billion unbanked. And I think that's going to be an incredible opportunity, and that's going to happen. The fact is that, you know, as the world becomes more challenged in terms of developed markets, people are moving towards developing markets and the ability to be able to tap into that. So, and the implications of that is, you know, is going to be quite phenomenal. So, I think most financial institutions and particularly will be moving towards those areas of Africa, Middle East, Asia, and of course, and some of the South American countries. In terms of, I think developed markets, as I mentioned earlier, I think in order to be successful, productivity is going to be important. I think people who possibly should have made, or countries and an organization which should have potentially made some significant structural changes before the global financial crisis have now been forced to do that now because of the being effectively not being able to make hay when the sun was shining in terms of productivity, and now finding that they have to do that. Unfortunately, that's come at a cost in terms of employment for some of the developed countries. And I think the other element that I think is changing the world is the social network. I mean, I'm a product of, I thought with Microsoft coming and internet coming, I thought that was a massive change, but you know, the social networks and the way my children, for example, use it. And now we're seeing increasingly how customers are starting to use these social networks and how people are starting to protest and be able to utilize it for moving trends, I think is an incredible thing. So these social networks are going to be an incredible, has going to have a profound impact, I think, going forward.
So what are your top recommended resources and why?
In terms of my resources, I tend to find that I'm one of these people who, by talking, picks up a lot of information. And so one of my top resources actually is meeting people like yourself and moving and meeting up with other people in other organizations and generally going through. But otherwise, I tend to surf the net quite a bit. I read a lot of different things. I have an eclectic taste. So I tend to do that, and I read snippets from, you know, things like Bloomberg and Reuters all the time, which are of interest. So for me, the resources is, you know, for an old guy, I'm very much driven by the new world of technology, and I tend to have things like, you know, the lightest computer to be able to read. So I don't tend to buy books. I tend to, you know, read magazines or read books through the computer rather than through the old-fashioned way of carrying books around and so on. So those tend to be my resources nowadays. But principal resources, I think, talking to people, I enjoy and picking up information all the time while traveling.
You know, you talk about people being sort of a great resource, and I found you extremely engaging. I know that I talked to many executives at the summit. I would say that you were the most engaging executive at that Beijing summit. And it's clear that you enjoy communicating and working with and building relationships with people.
I absolutely love it. I think, you know, I think is it Lee Iacocca who said that if you don't like people, you know, you should get out of of being in leadership roles. And I think for me that's, you know, that's a fundamental element of it. I'm normally a fairly introverted person, but I enjoy having a one-on-one conversation or, you know, particularly in small groups.
Again, because you're so well-traveled and you've got such an amazing history of success. You must have some interesting stories that you can share, maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing or humorous.
I think one story that actually sticks out as a probably a profound element for me was a few years ago when the Asian tsunami struck in 2004. There was an incredible amount of outpouring in Australia to provide aid to many parts of the world. And Westpac was able to raise a lot of money, and we raised over $1 million, and of which half of that, nearly half of that, $400,000, we gave to a microfinancing group in India. And that microfinancing group was a company that was, well, an institution that was globally recognized, so we were very comfortable giving that money. And it was my role as the Asian head to go and hand the check over. So when I went to hand the check over, I found the person said, oh, you know, you must come and look around and get a bit of an understanding of how this money is spent. And then the basic fundamentals of this microfinancing was that effectively this equivalent to $100 is given as a loan. And it's only given to women as a loan, which is a standard model that seems to be occurring all over the world. And that, and the part of the reason why it's given to the women is that they're more reliable in terms of repayment, and they tend to be the ones who drive the family in most of the areas, most of the countries where, you know, there's a developing countries. And because they tend to be having, you know, taking responsibility for the children, children's education, of course, household and the like. So I went and saw three or four different women who had received these loans. And it was an incredible achievement for some of these people to what they've done. And one, you know, one of a couple of the stories were one woman whose husband was a drunk and an alcoholic, and so he's basically of little contribution, was providing little contribution to the house. She got the money, and she used to sell fried peanuts in the beaches of Chennai in India in the evenings to earn some money. So out of that, she had, out of the $100 that was given, there was a certain rules that were applied to that. One was that every month a certain amount had to be repaid as part of the loan, certain amount had to be put away as savings, and a certain amount, the remaining amount, was utilized for normal survival. And so this lady, which is effectively bought one of these carts which was selling hot peanuts, and she made enough money in a very short period of time. By the time I went, which was about 9 or 10 months later, she had three carts. Due to her entrepreneurial skills, she had three carts, and in fact she had employed three men now to effectively sell these peanuts. And she was putting her son through a private school, I mean, not a very expensive private, but it's nevertheless not a government school, and at the same time still continuing to cook at home and keeping the house clean. And the house was an area, you know, what probably would be called a shanty town in other parts of the world, but when you go into that place, it was spotlessly clean inside, and it almost brought tears to my eyes in the way that this incredible individual had taken this money and with this little opportunity used an incredible amount of entrepreneurial skills to be able to grow a business from nothing. And only thing she was needed was a bit of a hand to be able to move it along. And there was another similar story where a lady, again, was given the money with similar sort of background. She started a bicycle business whereby she bought initially one bicycle and used to lease it out every day for a certain amount of money for individuals to go to work, and they had to bring it back. And by the time I went, as I said, about 8 or 9 months later, she had increased that to about 25 bicycles, and she was leasing that out. And she was now having a reasonably strong business in terms of leasing that. Now, subsequent to that, I have visited that place every year since then, and the cycling lady, for example, now she has 1,000 bicycles, and she is, you know, a true business manager, and she has sales. When you go to her business, she has sales meetings, she talks about budgeting, a lot of stuff that we actually do with our bank managers. And I was just incredibly proud of not only our organization for, you know, providing that, but I was incredibly proud of the lady And I was, from my perspective, it was something that I wanted my children to learn from, which was, with the smallest of the meager amount of beginning, you can make a significant contribution if you work hard and if you apply yourself, and which is all of, again, as we were talking earlier, these are all life stories of how important it was to be persistent, be motivated and continue to, have a vision that was for the long term. And in this particular case, the only thing we had to do was to just give a slight assistance. And it was only a meager assistance. And with that, there's been incredible amount of growth. And in fact, out of that 400,000, I think we have probably created about 135,000 jobs in the last 4 years. So, that's why I take off my hat to people like, the Grameen Bank and so on, because, what they do has incredible social impact, not just within the country, but I think globally.
Well, those are quite inspirational stories. And I guess what we'd want to do then is engage the audience to do these kinds of things as well, to get involved.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I think throughout the world, things are starting to happen. People are starting to recognize the global warming, and people are, I think I read something in the UK that are counties which effectively encourage people to, each individual to plant 7 trees. And it might seem like a small thing, 7 trees every year, and it might seem like a small thing to do, but the amazing impact of that on a global sense is phenomenal. And if everybody chips in with a little effort, I think, we can all collectively get massive benefits from it.
Well, we're down to our last question in this interview, and that's kind of where I turn the tables and I say, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
If I was asking questions, I think the things that I get really excited and fascinated about talking to other people is about leadership, for example. And one of the questions would be about leadership. What are the aspects of leadership would you consider that would make a good leader? And I'm always interested in listening to people's perspective of that. The other two are, slightly different, which is, what keeps people awake at night is a standard question you hear in most companies all the time. And I would normally ask, and in terms of global, I mean, I don't necessarily mean in terms of his company, in one's individual company, but in terms of globally, what are the things that keep people awake at night? And what are the three things that would make someone excited in terms of the future of the world as well? Those are the three questions I would ask in terms of if I was asked to ask questions.
Okay, now what are your answers on that leadership questions? What keeps you awake at night and the three things that make you excited?
The three things, I think, for in terms of the exciting, I think, as elements of it is that for me, I'm in a region which is growing, and what I'm excited by the fact is that my children are able to embrace these changes and the cultures and so on. So I am really excited by the fact that the world, whilst it's getting smaller in some regard, it's also becoming a more tolerant world, I think, in many ways compared to what I've seen in the past. So I'm excited by the social impact of as well as the financial benefits that comes out of being in a growth market of, in terms of employment, in terms of seeing organizations grow, people grow, and so on. So I find that incredibly interesting. In terms of sleepless at night, I guess I do worry at times about the fact that, there is a disparity that is occurring in a global sense. The disparity that is starting to occur between the haves and the have-nots. And the sooner we start to address some of that would be, the better it is. But having said that, though, I am encouraged by the activities that most, parts of the world, people are doing to try and address those things, whether it be in emerging markets or whether it's in developed markets. So I think in terms of the sleepless aspects of it, I think, I would like to see less disparity and in terms of people. And in terms of leadership, I think for me the most important part I see as leadership is to be able to be sticking to your values, to be fair-minded and effectively. And this is something that, through hard work and effectively showing the way by hard work. I mean, if you're able to provide to your team and the people that you work with that you have a certain set of values and you're a person that is persevering and you're a person that is focused on achieving goals, I think generally people tend to follow you pretty well. And you're able to get you're able to win their hearts and minds because they see you as a fair person. And if you're seen as a fair person, fair-minded person, I think you tend to be a reasonable leader. Well, I at least hope so. I'm not necessarily saying I'm all of that all the time, but I do admire people who are able to do all those things consistently.
Within your own executive team, you discuss some of the sort of defined leadership qualities, for example, of your CEO.
Yeah, our CEO is incredibly, we have a lady CEO and she's incredibly engaging. And the thing that I think we all admire about her the most is the fact that she's a very grounded person and she's a very genuine person. And when you're a person who's genuine and grounded and people are able to very much relate to that individual. And so when you're able to relate, you're able to, to be able to be follow and be, engaging and feel part of the team. And I think being part of the team is an important part of being able to be a leader. And that's what she does.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that good leaders are also authentic.
Absolutely. I think that's... I think you hit the right word. I think that authenticity is the right word, I think. Be genuine, absolutely.
Well, that very much comes across with you, Yoga, and you're very authentic, you're very engaging, you're visionary, you're exciting, I mean, you're passionate. It always comes across when people talk with you. So I can see why you were invited to represent this fine banking organization at the Beijing Summit, I know that just seeing you do your work, it was just fascinating to watch it because you're just so good at what you do.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year coming forward.
Well, thank you, Yogan, and we will continue to follow your significant global and regional contributions. And again, we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Thank you very much. Thanks again, and thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to speak to you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Yogan Rathanayakam, General Manager Asia for West Bank Banking Corporation, past Chairman of the Bankers Association for Finance and Trade Asia Pacific, and globally recognized banking senior executive.